Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 2nd, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, host of The Discourse, Brandon Sutton, will be joining us to discuss the various things that have taken place this week in the news. Also joining us later, from the AM Quickie, Lucy Steiner will be here to discuss more of the news, because we've got a lot of news. She, of course, is a comedian and editor and host of the AM Quickie. Meanwhile, Donald and Melania Trump test positive for coronavirus. And late breaking, Senator Mike Lee has now also tested positive. So far, Pence and Coney Barrett have tested negative, but it appears that Donald Trump knew he had been exposed to someone who had tested positive, Hope Hicks, and then went on to potentially expose hundreds of other people. Meanwhile, we are awaiting a test on Joe Biden. Kamala Harris tests negative. And in the Senate, endangered Republican senators reverse course. They side with Democrats on the ACA destroying lawsuit. In the House, House Democrats pass another stimulus bill, this one for $2.2 trillion that the Republicans will shut down. Meanwhile, the economy stalling. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announces he'll make it harder for Texans to vote. And conservative operatives Berkman and Wall are charged by the Michigan AG in an alleged voter suppression scheme. South Carolina Republican seeks to make mail-in voting much harder. And census takers are saying that the Commerce Department is shutting them down despite a court order for them to keep counting. Meanwhile, Amy Coney Barrett, her nomination is starting to get a little bit shaky, folks. She signed an anti-Roe v. Wade ad and neglected to tell the Judiciary Committee about it. 1,600 former DOJ lawyers accuse Bill Barr of electioneering. And a Melania Trump confidant is working with prosecutors on the inauguration's finances. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, a welcome to the show. We have quite a day for us here. I don't know that there is anyone who could be possibly listening to this program by now who's not aware that the President of the United States, despite the fact that he has said on multiple occasions that the coronavirus really doesn't impact anybody. I mean, nobody important has contracted the coronavirus, as has Melania Trump contracted the coronavirus. Presumably it's from Hope Hicks, who it was reported yesterday had contracted the coronavirus. Donald Trump was infected the night of the debate. It is unclear whether he was spreading the virus at that time. You're in a closed room. You're maybe 10 feet away from Joe Biden. Of course, you're yelling and you're screaming and in an unhinged way. Perhaps he infected Joe Biden. We don't know. We really don't know who else in his circle has contracted it. I mean, there are the results have come back for Pence. At least it's been reported that he is negative. But of course, Hope Hicks was reported negative and the next day reported positive. So it's very difficult to know. We do know that Donald Trump knew that Hope Hicks was infected and then went, I think it was to Bedminster Country Club and met with high donor supporters. So I guess, I don't know if they meant to do it this way, but very often what will happen is when you go to see donors, they get some type of, you know, commemorative, I don't know, photo or plaque. That's my understanding with high money donors. I don't think that the president meant to give them coronavirus as some type of commemorative, you know, thing. That would be bizarre. But it's quite possible that's what happened. The level of irresponsibility that the Trump administration, that the White House has been engaging in, has been apparent to everyone for months, both in terms of the way that they have made it very, very difficult to contain this virus throughout the country because of the misinformation they have disseminated, because of the in some instances, I don't know, you call it misinformation. I mean, it was outright lies about the coronavirus. And it now appears that that level of irresponsibility has been, has also taken place amongst Trump staffers, amongst national security folks, people who work in our government, perhaps the people who protect the president, Secret Service, maybe military personnel, Marines. It's stunning. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people who are celebrating this. You know, I don't know that it's particularly a time to celebrate. I also know, I'm sure, I would imagine, there are many conservatives out there who are angry at the president for having a complete lack of personal responsibility. That seems to me to be a little bit extreme, but maybe, you know, that is in line with their principles, as it were. What is really chilling now is to watch some of the clips that have taken place over the past couple of days in the debate, following the debate, and sort of see these in the context that they were. Let's play this clip of Donald Trump. We will play it again. Donald Trump mocking Joe Biden for being so overly cautious about wearing his mask. Understand that every single word that Donald Trump is saying here is accompanied with, more than likely, a certain amount of virus being projected out.
President Trump, you have begun to increasingly question the effectiveness of masks as a disease preventer. And in fact, recently you have cited the issue of waiters touching their masks and touching plates. Are you questioning
the efficacy of masks? No, I think masks are okay. You have to understand, if you look, I mean, I have a mask right here. I put a mask on, you know, when I think I need it. Tonight, as an example, everybody's had a test and you've had social distancing and all of the things that you have to. But I wear masks when needed. When needed, I wear masks.
OK, let me ask.
I don't wear masks like him. Every time you see him, he's got a mask. He could be speaking 200 feet away from it. He shows up with the biggest mask I've ever seen.
Vice President Biden, go ahead, sir.
Look, the way to open businesses is give them the wherewithal to be able to open.
Okay, we don't need to see any more. I mean, I imagine Chris Wallace is getting a test this morning. if he hasn't already. I wouldn't want to be on a plane that is actually lower than the president in that situation, because we know it aerosolizes. We know that that tends to drop a little bit. It depends on the humidity in there. There he is.
Here's some guidance about singing and yelling and is dangerous. So,
and, you know, I mean, really, it's going to come down to we still don't know the perfect timeline yet. Now, understand, the White House, their intention was to not let anyone know. This is according to the New York Times, to not let anyone know that Hope Hicks was infected. They knew this apparently on Thursday early. I don't think Donald Trump knew that he was infected at that time. It's just, we just don't know the timeline, so we don't know how infectious he was. It's unbelievably, it's both unbelievable and totally believable. And, you know, for those people who are, look, if I were in the practice of issuing individual best wishes to the 7 million people who have contracted coronavirus in this country, to the hundreds of thousands who have died, to the even more of those people who have been hospitalized, if I was in the practice of wishing best wishes to those people, I would do that now for the president and for the first lady. But I'm not. And until I have the time to issue best wishes to all those people, you won't hear me do it for the president. I have no special affinity for the president. What's really disturbing on some level is, you know, my 15-year-old daughter is like, he deserves it. And she's not getting that from me. She's a sentient human being. She has seen what he has done to the country. She goes to a school of 4,500 kids, a lot of whom are immigrants. She had Muslim students in her class when Donald Trump was elected and was talking about the Muslim ban. She has friends of all different races and backgrounds. She's fully aware of what kind of person Donald Trump is as an individual, or not really so much as an individual, because who knows? Certainly as a president. And it's sort of sad that my parents would talk about where they were on the day that JFK was shot. And they would talk about the horror of it. And there's generations of young people, in particular, young people, who are going to, who potentially could be talking about this day in a very different manner than people talk about where they were, where JFK was. And, you know, I think that's the responsibility of the president. She is fully aware of how Donald Trump has. And everyone is. Now, the president has said it was a hoax, a Democratic hoax. How just days ago, nobody really gets it. Nobody gets sick from it. Only if you got diabetes, I think he said, or something to that effect. Let's look at this clip. This is a comedy bit by Donald Trump Jr. and Sean Hannity. Moments after the debate, presumably. I mean, I don't know if we've heard if Don Jr. has been tested. He very well may have antibodies. Remember, his girlfriend was
Kim Guilfoyle.
Kim Guilfoyle had it. Incidentally, there's also a massive piece in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer about Kim Guilfoyle, where a former employee over at Fox charged her with all sorts of really inappropriate things, ranging from sexual harassment to inappropriate treatment as her employee. But let's play this clip of Donald Trump Jr. and Sean Hannity. This is Donald Trump Jr. Making a joke. And all of this stuff seems really sort of eerie now. Now, we don't know. Maybe Donald Trump Jr. had not been that close to his father or Hope Hicks or Melania to get infected, or maybe he already had antibodies. I'm not sure. We don't know. And who knows? Maybe Sean Hannity was that close too. But here is their exchange. This is funny stuff, folks.
Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr. You know, we both have been COVID tested.
We've been tested. I don't want to get, you know, they'll throw us in the gulag.
Where's my mask?
Close,
so. Yeah. All right. So you're sitting in here.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Where's my mask? Hope Hicks was tested. I believe it was on Tuesday. Right. And or Wednesday. She tested negative on one day, and the next day she tested positive. Which means that somewhere in between that time, I mean, first off, we don't know if the first test was just simply inaccurate, or she hadn't, there was not enough viral load to register at that point. At one point over the course of that 24 hours, at the very least, there was. So we don't know. I mean, that joking around and not taking it seriously. And it's, look, if they're sitting in a bar and they're doing that with each other, it's none of our business. There's no implications other than the people that they deal with in their personal lives. But when they do that on television, when they do that in the context of modeling for millions of people, I'm sorry, they have an obligation to society. And when they fail at that obligation willfully, with such righteousness in their failure to do so, I'm sorry, the idea of feeling any sympathy for these people is absurd. It's absurd. It's offensive. It's offensive. It really is. I find it offensive, frankly. These people have an obligation. And they, you know, people make mistakes. And I don't think that you should be, you know, that happens. But this isn't a mistake. This isn't an accident. This is a willful, premeditated, in many instances, attempt to diminish the reality of a pandemic that has killed over 200,000 people in this country alone, never mind the tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of people who will have a lifetime of medical issues, the millions who are now ineligible for health insurance if these people get their way. I'm sorry, it's offensive to me to show them an iota of more sympathy, unless you have been, as a practice, doing that for every single individual in the country who has contracted this. I thought this was going to be a little more light, but I'm sorry. I really do. I find it just disgusting. Really disgusting. I mean, because we don't know the extent of this. We don't know if Donald Trump infected Joe Biden. We don't know how many senators are infected. We don't know how many, like I said, staffers, people who, you know, they just have a job where they're supposed to drive the president somewhere. And there was no one who could say, yeah, Mr. President, maybe you should wear a mask. Or, Mr. President, maybe these people around you, I know it makes you feel uncomfortable, they should wear a mask. there are reports that there was a doctor at the debate. They had it at the Cleveland. I can't even remember the name of it now. Cleveland Clinic. And there was a doctor who went over with masks to hand to the essentially the Trump entourage. And the doctor was waved off. Even though it was protocol, even though that was the rules. They're above the rules. And I don't know if Donald Trump is going to get sick. I don't know if Melania Trump is going to get sick. Somebody is going to get very, very ill, at least. And it's quite possible somebody's going to die specifically because of their very narrow behavior. I don't express sympathy for people like that. There's too much. There's too many people in line before them that I don't have time to get to.
And not enough time.
There's not enough time. They don't get to skip the line because they are celebrities who also happen to have done some horrible, horrible, horrible things. That just doesn't work that way with me. Man, I feel like I need to have a little bit of word from our sponsors. I'm going to have to take a double dose of that Sunset Lake CBD to calm down.
By the way, did you mention they're reporting Biden tested negative?
Oh, he did?
Yep. Just released moments ago.
All right, that's good news. We're going to need another day.
Yeah.
Or two. And I imagine he's going to get tested every 12 hours. I would think. But that's good news. So SunsetLakeCBD.com, they sent me a really nice note this week. The response that they've been getting from this audience has been, they've been overwhelmed by it. I mean, in a good way. Emotionally overwhelmed, but not in terms of their service, because they send things out very quickly, is my understanding. They have 100% pesticide-free hemp. They only use organic fertilizers. Customers can see the third-party test results. They have it on their website. This is a farm that used to exclusively produce dairy milk for Ben & Jerry's. And now they split off, I think it was about a year or two ago, with the help of University of Vermont. They are practicing regenerative agriculture practices. They have a self-imposed $15 minimum wage. Employees own the majority of the company. And their business practices are not even the best thing about this company, as far as I'm concerned. Their product is. They have smokables. So if you don't want to feel too stoned, as it were, I think that's what the kids say today, right? Stoned. You can smoke CBD and you just get like a body high, right? Is that how you describe it, Mac? I mean, I've tried it once. Yeah. I've tried one of those pre-rolls once and I found it really actually incredibly relaxing.
Yeah, I would say definitely a body high.
They have pre-rolls. They have, Matt loves the smalls. They also have a topical salve with an arnica that I've talked about that helps me with my eczema, but, I've sent it to people who have back pain. We've gotten letters from people who use it for their arthritis. Everybody is pretty, everybody has said it's been awesome for them. They have a dark roast Peruvian coffee that is infused with CBD. I've sent that as a gift to people, and the tinctures are my go-to. You get a dropper. They have 750, 1,500, 3,000 mils. And I just gave my sister some of the gummy bears. So they have all sorts of products there, and they're giving you 20% off, 20%. Go to Left is Best. That's one word. Left is Best, I should say, is the coupon code at sunsetlakecbd.com. Also, one of the things that has gotten me through this era and it's good for, it's been, I don't want to say that it's like, you know, brought my family together. But I mean, it is, there's a great way to have some fun with family members or friends that does not involve screen time. That for me is like the, that is the key. And it is a game called Hunt a Killer. It's a murder mystery subscription box. They send it to you every month. And with each delivery, you sift through piles of documents. They have evidence, audio recordings that they put on like a thumb drive, case files. And this is what you do with Hunt a Killer. You basically, it's like, it's a murder mystery game and you figure out who the killer is. You crack the case, you catch the killer. You don't have to chase after him. I mean, it's, that doesn't work that way, but you figure it out. You learn the backstories for each of the suspects. You figure out their relationships, which tend to be extremely complicated. You watch the story unfold as you complete each episode or box, essentially. And if you can't bear to wait a month for your next box, there's an expedite button. You can get it there earlier. I've been doing this with Myla. We did one about a high school reunion, and it's fun. We did the whole thing with the bulletin board and the red yarn and the pictures, and you can get as crazy as you want with it. There's also like an online community where you can go on and get, they don't give you spoilers, but they give you clues. You can talk about theories. So you can do it by yourself, I guess, if you wanted to, but it's really, for me, it's great with your kids, older kids. It's an older kid game, but no screen time. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. Head to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off and show your support for our podcast. That's huntakiller.com/majority. Okay. Let's welcome our guest to the program. Let's take a little bit of a quick musical break as we bring on Brandon Sutton. Okay, that is who are the guys who did that? That is a cover, the first cover ever, I think, of Pilot Light by Dave Derby. Who did that, Brendan?
The Geo Trio.
The Geo Trio. I tweeted it out, but people should go check them out. It's actually an awesome cover, and I sent it to Dave Derby, and he was super psyched. Super psyched. He was really enjoyed it. All right. On the Zoom, I guess it is, on the video feed, Brandon Sutton, host of The Discourse, or co-host. Is that right, Brandon?
I mean, I don't know what the difference between being the host and the co-host is. I lead the show with my three other, you know, pundits, thought partners, whatever you want to call it, of Richard, Adair, and John. So yeah, I'm the co-host. I'm ready to take a back seat in my own show. I'm ready to, you know, basically just cash a check. I don't even need to show up.
Yeah, no, that's the dream, right? That's living the dream.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, will you just do me a favor? Put your microphone just a little bit closer. We're getting a little bit of your room tone.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, that's great.
I'll hold it like this.
Yeah, that's great. So, Brandon, you know, 24 hours ago, maybe 12 hours ago, I thought, okay, well, we're going to talk about Amy Coney Barrett, and there's been some movement on her, and we'll get into this a little bit, but this ad emerged that she signed years ago, but basically very explicitly calling for the repeal of Roe v. Wade. And that is a question that you are asked when you go in front of the Judiciary Committee, and when you write out your the questionnaire. Have you ever signed anything that you know, directly implicates a potential case that you may be hearing in the future? And she declined to mention that she had signed that very public ad, maybe thinking it was 20 years ago. Maybe she forgot. But that seemed to put a little bit of scare in somebody within the Republican caucus, because Mitch McConnell sort of backed off his idea of having the hearings pre-election. We'll return to that, because these are all the things that are going to be implicated. We have the the race as it is, polls around the country. We have Melania Trump being investigated, or not her necessarily, but the financing around the inauguration being investigated, which in part led to the release of a tape that shows that she really doesn't like the idea of doing Christmas decorations, which I know it's shocking. It is shocking. We have,
it's so good, though.
We have almost a half a dozen Republican senators who must be really afraid of losing their seats and, over the issue of health care, because they have reversed essentially their previous positions by supporting Democrats in an attempt to stop the DOJ from destroying the ACA in a lawsuit. We have the passage of another stimulus bill as reports of the economy are, you know, flagging from even its like sort of anemic recovery that was happening. And then we have, of course, the daily dispatch of Republicans attempting to keep people from voting, all of which is overshadowed by the fact that the president has the coronavirus, as does the first lady, as does Senator Mike Lee. And we don't know who else at this point. I mean, I imagine there's a lot of people in our government who are getting tested right now.
I mean, look, we I just think back to the debate. I think back to that one moment at the debate where he literally reaches into his sort of suit jacket pocket and he goes, I love masks. I wear masks everywhere. But, you know, today everyone's been tested. It's fine. You know, we're following social distance guidelines. And I'm just like, yeah. are you? I mean, I think ultimately we're going to see, you know, these, we know that a lot of the, well, first of all, we know that the coronavirus, a lot of the initial ideas surrounding who were spreading it were these ultra rich people who are, you know, traveling for conventions, traveling for vacations, traveling around, you know, for any number of reasons, right? And I think that the level of access to rapid response testing that, you know, some people enjoy, it insulates them from the worst effects of coronavirus for sure, but there is still that grace period of 4 or 5 days where, yeah, people are contagious and they'll test negative, right? So I think we're seeing a lot of that kind of come into play here where it's like, yeah, you know, this is not the kind of thing you can just entirely insulate yourself from simply by having access to all the best things. You're going to have to actually sort of wait it out, right? At least to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really fascinating point, because I would I think that at the beginning of this, and I'm talking like in early March, late February, where it starts to spread in this country, it is a function of people who have traveled either for conferences or whatnot, or coming from Europe and coming back and forth. And then, of course, the brunt of it is bared by people who are low income, and are expected to work through this and need to work through this and don't have their own cars or using public transport or are living in denser areas or have less access to high quality medical care. And then we move into sort of the era where it's just sort of like a more like, you know, as we get to more rural areas into the Midwest, it's really more of a function of like just people just not believing that it's real. And then you have people who are, like you say, the elite, who are using these rapid tested regimes and assume that they're safe and then turn out not to be. It is, I mean, look, here's the thing. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a public health policy expert who, if they were being totally honest, wouldn't say, regardless of what happens to the president, this is a positive for the country because maybe people will take it more seriously now. Right? Like, I mean, the idea that the president, who was probably the chief proponent of the idea that you are fine, you don't have to worry too much about this, as long as you don't have, you're not really old, or you're not, you know, have some type of comorbidity or something like that, has been telling people that. And now, and people think like, oh, I can't get it, it's overblown, whatnot. And now he's got it, and it may have the opportunity to re-educate people to some extent.
Well, maybe, or he might just be another Bolsonaro who has had COVID-19, what, 17 times right now by this point and has not died. And the danger of that, I think, is that, yeah, when you're talking about somebody who's prone to reactionary thinking, kind of like Trump is, if he gets COVID and he's fine, just for maybe he's asymptomatic, maybe he is just like a freak of nature who just doesn't have any, like he has it and it's like a small, you know, flu, small cold. He gets the sniffles. He seems kind of like a baby. So he's going to be very like about it no matter what, you know, that is going to influence how he thinks about it. It just might reaffirm their beliefs, right? That, okay, well, you know what? Trump got it. He was fine. He's 70 plus years old. What's, you know, like, then I'll be fine too, right? Of course, that also erases just like the chances of just like being fine randomly or just the access to the level of healthcare he has. So, you know, yep. I think there's a danger on both sides, right? If this is the, you know, teachable moment that lets Trump take it seriously, great, I suppose, but I doubt that's going to be the case. Well, just another point to, you know, more broadly, I think when it comes to the rapid testing scenario too, you know, more broadly speaking, you're talking about like COVID generally, people thinking the solution lies in just like a technological response. Like the only way we're going to solve COVID, rapid testing and like a vaccine, that's the solution to COVID. And of course that's part of the solution. Obviously that's like the, you know, end goal, but a lot of this is just behavioral changes. You know, it's social changes. It's like having to reorient society in a way that people don't necessarily like to hear about because it sounds difficult and it might be costly and, you know, whatever. So the idea that there's just going to one day be a magical vaccine that is 100% effective is just like the only thing that might be, you know, it's like, it's the goal in people's minds when a lot right. of this is just always going to be like changing your behavior.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder, it'll be fascinating to see, you know, in New York, we're seeing numbers tick up and over the past couple of weeks, largely as a function of the Hasidic community. But you know, there's no way to contain it in any area. You know, every area has, it seems to me, part of the country has like their, you know, sort of the, their problem areas in terms of developing. In South Dakota, it was bike, you know, motorcycle rally. In New York, it's like, the Hasidic community. And then obviously it spreads outward from there because it's just, it's hard. Nobody is really completely walled off in any fashion. I wonder, and one of the things that epidemiologists have said to me on this program is that, you know, peak to peak, 6 months. And the second peak is generally bigger than the first. Now, in New York, that would mean October. It would mean around now. And it's starting to creep a little bit up, but who knows? I wonder if an event like this, where the president gets it, and like you say, we don't know how, you know, 40% of the people who get it, they may not even know it, that they have it. The president apparently, though, was showing some symptoms, mild symptoms, but it's early on. You don't know where it can go. We will know in the next 5 or 6 days as to like how bad it gets. But I wonder if it's going to like even maybe possibly prevent a second spike in some areas, because I'm not convinced that part of the reason why you get a second spike is not necessarily a change in the virus, but rather a change in, like you say, the behavior that people adopt. Because we've been outside for the past 6 months, at least, you know, or not 6 months, past 2 or 3 months in the Northeast, 4 or 5 months, I guess. And people get used to like, it's very hard to transmit it outside. And people are wearing masks. But at one point, it's like, wait, we got to go inside because it's getting too cold. And inside is very, very tricky. And it's very easy to just take the mask off and think like, oh, we're fine, like the Trump folks. And then find that, no, you're not fine. And I wonder if this in some ways will sort of like remind people that anybody can get it at any time.
I mean, I think that is one version of events, the optimistic view. I think also when you're talking about behavioral changes over time in this kind of situation, we have to look at the idea, you know, the fact that, you know, we're still struggling with getting, you know, basic aid for most people from the government. Like we're still struggling for, you know, getting rent relief. We're still struggling for getting unemployment insurance where, you know, another round of stimulus checks would be great, but look how long we had to wait for those stimulus checks, right? So part of that equation is going to always be like, well, in many places, the government has just abandoned people. And, you know, you can do, I guess I would say, what does it really mean to take COVID-19 seriously as an individual in the absence of like any kind of structural support? right? Because I think that, you know, we can pick out problematic communities all over the place. We can pick out, you know, ones that are racially or religiously motivated. We can pick out ones that are just like college students. Like they're just going to go to, they're going to go party at college, right? But like, it's just not a reasonable or practical thing to do, I think, in epidemiology even, to try to control the behavior of individuals without some kind of structural incentive to behave that way, right? Because people have to go to work, you said, right? People have to go to work. People have to, you know, people have to exercise. They have to buy groceries. They have to, and they have to commute too, right? Especially in New York City, where they have to drive the train. Most people do public transportation. So I think, you know, part of the thing that we've been grappling with, I think, as a country, like, is the blame game part of this. Like, you know, now that we've rather, in the absence of structural support from the government, in the absence of a real ability to demand it from them, the only thing we feel like we can do, I think, sometimes, is like point out who's not following the rules properly and try to self-police, right? But then you talk about, you know, restaurant, in like in-person restaurant dining, it's like, but then basically we've just deputized customer, like service employees, to be the new like mask police, right? You know, we've deputized people who make sub minimum wage, like serving, you know, serving drinks to like drunk guys, to like make sure that they're also like public health officials, right? So I mean, at a certain point, we have to talk about, like, as the COVID continues to ravage the country, and people still lack support, eventually they're just going to be inclined to do what they, you know, just do what they do, right?
Right, right. No, it's a very good point. And I think to a certain extent, it is it's about sequencing, right? Like, you know, Donald Trump has all the support in the world, like literally all the support in the world. And so you could hold him to a higher standard, or at least to maybe hold him to the same standard that you would other people. But the sequence has to be, you need a context in which it is not all incumbent upon you, that you are incentivized in some ways. I mean, I think they, what do they call that? Cludge or something like that. I can't, not cludge, but, you know, nudge, or whatever it is. I mean, you need to provide a context where it makes it much easier for people to make a decision. I'm not going to work. And they're going to go to work if they don't have the ability to support themselves or to take care of themselves. They're not going to go to the hospital if they don't have health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a really good point. All right, let's just turn to there's so many different stories that are going on right now that, there's two major ones, it seems to me. One is, I mean, obviously the election, and who knows? I mean, who knows? There may not be any more debates, right? I mean, Donald Trump, the protocol is he's quarantined for 14 days, but that presumes that he doesn't even have symptoms, right? I mean, if he has symptoms and he's sick, he needs to quarantine for even longer because he may be infectious for even longer. We don't know. And so, and there are calls that Joe Biden shouldn't campaign. Is it just absurd at this point?
When did he start? When did he start? Sorry.
Well, the irony is they were just announced that they're going to launch in-person campaigning. Bernie Sanders has announced like yesterday that they're going out to campaign in person. The Biden campaign is just now starting to send people out to canvass. I mean, that's the irony of this, is that you're right. When did he start? The plan was to start this week. And so who knows what's going to happen in that regard. There's the Amy Coney Barrett thing. And right now, Mike Lee has tested positive. He's going to quarantine for 14 days. They still have plenty of Republicans to sit on that committee to maintain a quorum in the Judiciary Committee. But that includes Graham, Tillis, and Ernst. These are senators who are in big trouble right now. And, you know, Grassley, Cornyn's got to be in Texas, maybe. He doesn't seem to be too threatened there. So he may be able to come back. But if I'm these guys, I'm a little hesitant to come back. Chuck Grassley, these are older gentlemen. Ted Cruz can be around. Ben Sasse can be around. Josh Hawley might be able to, but Tillis needs to go back to North Carolina because he's in a very tight race. Ernst needs to be in Iowa because she's in a tight race. And you've got Blackburn and Kennedy and I guess Crapo. And supposedly McConnell is pushing to have the hearings in 2 weeks. give me your sense of how this is going to play out. I mean, do you think McConnell's going to try and, I mean, at this point, let me ask you this, something more specific. Do you think the Democrats should show up at these hearings? Because I'm of two minds. One is this whole process is illegitimate. It doesn't matter who you nominate. You could have nominated Merrick Garland. This should not be happening now. Or now with this new stuff about Roe v. Wade being so explicit that it endangers maybe a couple of senators who are a little bit afraid to vote in this way. Maybe in places like, I don't know, in Arizona, maybe even in Iowa. What is your sense of this?
Well, I guess it really depends, in my sense, on like how hard the Democrats are willing to push Amy, right? You know, how hard are they willing to actually, you know, pin this on Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court? Because like, yeah, I think that in the absence of a few of these, like, you know, Republican senators, they should just turn into a referendum on Roe v. Wade. They should turn into a referendum on her history of lying. They should turn it on a referendum on, you know, basically the Republicans, right? However, I think that the choice of this particular candidate was not one that was made just haphazardly. You know, it's made to, I think, you know, basically box the Democrats into a little bit of a, you know, into a little bit of a corner, right? We know that, you know, we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg unfortunately passed away. You know, we have a vacancy. I'm nominating a woman judge who's been on the courts for a decade. What's the problem? Right.
Well, she's
what's
been on for 3 years, yeah. To be clear. She was on for three years. She's in the, I think it's Seventh Circuit. She was a law professor at Notre Dame for over a decade.
I'm sorry, got my dates mixed up there. But my larger point is not necessarily how long she's been in the course, but that she's qualified, right? She is a qualified candidate in the most abstract sense of the word. And she sort of ticks these little symbolic, you know, boxes that Democrats like, right? You know, it's going to be hard for them, I think, in some situations, especially given the kind of way they discuss gender rights and women's rights and even racial rights, to, I think, pin her down on the Roe v. Wade thing and not have it come across as like, you know, attacking a woman for her position on like choice, right? You know, trying to make it more of an abstract thing versus just like, you know, an abstract identity thing that's hard to pin on somebody who's, you know, also within the realm of like making choices for her own body, as opposed to like keeping it in the realm of this is like a political issue and like you were caught lying. How do you kind of keep, you know, how do you justify that? And also how do you justify being so partisan on this court? Now, whether or not that can work and whether or not it is meaningful in preventing her nomination is debatable. But I think if they choose to show up, they need to actually be willing to sort of make a legitimate, or rather break themselves out of this like corner they put themselves in, where like if Trump just, you know, if he nominates a diamond and silk to the Supreme Court, they just can't do anything because they are like, you know, this is representation. This is the kind of, you know, inclusivity that we've talked about as being inherently radical and inherently sort of like progressive, like just the inclusion of more people with these like sort of tech, you know, these boxes ticked is right. Enough. And getting too into the details is just, you know, it's not fair, right? It's not fair to judge people based on their past. It's not fair to judge people based on personal opinions. So, I mean, they have, you know, like they do, pin themselves a little bit, but there's a way out of it, I'd imagine, if you're going to have to do it.
I mean, my concern is that Dianne Feinstein showed in Coney Barrett's hearing to the appellate court that she doesn't have the ability to nuance this argument in terms of Catholics. Coney Barrett had written in a law review article in the late 90s, basically saying that if you were a Catholic, like she is, who has a deep, abiding, really fundamentalist belief in Catholic teaching, that so that you would be fundamentally biased, and she was writing specifically about the death penalty, against the death penalty, then you should recuse yourself in those cases because of your attachment to the Catholic canon, as it were. And it just conveniently, she's pro death penalty. So she's asking other Catholics to recuse themselves in that situation. She doesn't believe the same thing when it comes to abortion, but it's a harder argument for her to make now because there is unequivocal proof, literally a signed document that says Roe v. Wade should be overturned. Now, the game that these justices play is that, like, I'm not going to comment on a case that I may hear because it would be prejudicial. Well, that cat's out of the bag now. There's an ad literally a full page newspaper ad. Like it's almost like a joke. It's like, I'm not going to broadcast this to everybody. You did. It's there. And so I still don't know if Dianne Feinstein, I mean, certainly there are people who have deep, deep concerns that she is just not adept enough at this point in her career to deal with this. And I guess we'll see. But I think this is really more a political question for those Republicans who are in jeopardy of losing their seat. Can they afford to vote for to confirm a nominee who at this point, like, it's one thing for you and I to say, like, of course she's going to vote against Roe v. Wade. It's another for a Republican woman in the suburbs, let's say, or frankly, anywhere else to say, well, we don't know how she's going to vote versus my opponent, Joni Ernst, my opponent, Tom Tillis, my opponent, Cory Gardner, my opponent, pick one in Arizona. They voted for a judge who has been explicit in overturning Roe v. Wade. When they cast this vote, it's as if they cast the vote to curb your ability to get an abortion. That's a much harder thing to do, I think. And that's why I think McConnell's been a little bit wavering. But now I wonder, with the president and maybe with the president with having had COVID and it sort of shaking up the dynamic here, and now I wonder if McConnell doesn't go full steam ahead. We're just in such an unprecedented time, and there's so many moving pieces. It's so difficult at this point to get an assessment as to what's going to happen. And just, you know, we got a couple minutes here. Same dynamic happening on some level. This whole, the president testing positive for COVID. I wonder how much it shakes up what's going on with the House. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats passed a $3.2 trillion bill, the HEROES Act. This was back in over the summer, nearly 4 months ago now, I guess. And it was what they called at the time a messaging bill. Some of the message was, we are so desperate to not have, we are so desperate to not upset the insurance industry that we're going to promote the idea of subsidizing COBRA as a solution to people's healthcare. Other things in there that were better for folks. And Pelosi got a lot of pressure from some of those frontline Democrats. They passed a new bill, $2.2 trillion less this time, trying to get closer to maybe what Republicans will sign off on. In many ways, it's structured as the same bill, just with shorter timelines so that the money expended was less. And the Senate, I think, is talking about a bill that's about half that size, maybe a little bit more. Do you think that this creates more pressure, and particularly with the economic numbers, do you think this creates more pressure on the Republicans and particularly the White House to pass something before then? Or is it just, are we too close to the election and they're just like, we're going to let it ride because in the event that Joe Biden wins, we don't want to in any way to provide any relief for the American public?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of, does it put pressure on the Republican Party, my answer is kind of the same with the, you know, Amy Barrett situation, where it's just, you know, situations can't put pressure on Republicans usually. It has to be the Democrats. It has to be the Democrats or some sort of mass political movement that's just uprising and causing, you know, mass unrest to the point where it can't be ignored. So the question more becomes, you know, can the Democrats use Trump being diagnosed with COVID and probably exposing, you know, everyone else to it to their advantage in a way that they normally can't seem to manage, right? I'm seeing a lot of Democrats who are just like, I pray for the FLOTUS and POTUS to get healthy and better and well. And it's like, that's fine, well and good. And we know they have to say that. You can't really say anything else. And that's fair, I guess. But like the fact that this should be a very easy way to pivot into like, yeah, but you know what? Trump may be fine, but other people don't have the same level of access to healthcare that he does. They don't have the same level of access, the same ability to quarantine for 14 days sometimes, the same, you know, infinite resources to draw upon if they happen to be sick. I got COVID. I was sick for like 2 months and it was terrible, right? They don't have, but a lot of people don't have the ability or the savings. I know I didn't to make it through that much time off of work, right? But luckily I can work from home or do other things. So, this can be a teachable moment for the country. This can be a teachable moment for, their voters, for Republicans, for anybody, but it kind of incumbent on Democrats to actually make it that and make a big deal out of it and use it as a cudgel, as opposed to sort of just like falling back on, propriety, right? Falling back on like, well, you can't be mean to Trump now because he has like coronavirus, but it's like, well, didn't he say it wasn't a big deal? wasn't it not a big deal last week? So, I mean, it comes down to like, maybe this is the time where we have to like, stand up and like, yeah, it's fine. Trump, he's going to be fine or not. That's up to him. But like other people are not within that position. But I think when you have a figure like Trump, you have a figure like any of our politicians or political media, it's easy for people to be, for them and their problems to be platformed and for people to demand empathy for them as like sort of a demand for empathy for the status quo. Right. So, I am more concerned not about like Trump, but like whether or not they can effectively weaponize Trump's illness, to be completely blunt, as a, way to say that, he was so wrong about COVID-19. He got it himself, and you can't say good for him, but like,
I think that last point you made, Brandon, is right on target. The fact of the matter is that every day there are thousands upon thousands. We have 40,000 people getting infected every day. And they don't have the resources that Donald Trump does. And we need to provide that to him. Brandon Sutton, folks can check out the discourse on any of your podcast services. Is that right?
Yeah, you absolutely can. You can find it on iTunes, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, found it on Patreon. I don't know if there are any other podcast platforms. No offense, a lot of podcasts come out and a lot of platforms come out, like the one True. Per each podcast. True. I can't keep up with them myself. I'm not a big podcast person. But you can find the discourse on all your major podcast platforms. We have a new episode coming out today on Patreon for all of our lovely subscribers about the debate.
Check it out.
Exactly.
All right, thanks,
Check it
Brandon.
Out. Thank you
Appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
All right, man. I want to just play this before we get to Lucy later in the program. Let's play this clip from clip number 4. It's Brian Kilmeade trying to make lemonade out of lemons.
Byron, there's something else. Think about the president. He's running the country, doing a campaign. He's a one-man machine, doesn't have a lot of surrogates outside his family doing a lot of the work that he can do. This is also an opportunity to recalibrate, strategize, prepare for the second debate, go over your tapes, go over these policies, study your opponent. That could be this forced study time, forced reflection time, and maybe, brainstorm.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It could be. And I think there's one thing that's really important to say. Obviously, this is a huge event. Huge events take a while to sink in for the public to kind of figure out what their reaction is, what they think about it. I personally don't think we've fully digested the debate, which was on Tuesday night. And so, early impressions are early and people talk to each other, they rethink things, and then they finally form an opinion. So I don't think we're even there yet with debate. So we don't know what effect the president getting coronavirus will have on this race. I think it'll have some effect, but it's going to be several days before we can really figure that out.
Well, all right. I mean, do they think there's going to be another debate in 13 days? The second debate.
Zoom debate. Let's do it.
The second debate is scheduled for October 15th. I mean, are they out of their minds? Who's going to show up at that debate? I mean, I that seems nuts to me. And I would hope right now they're trying to figure out a new way of doing the debate between Harris and Pence, if they're going to do that. But they're presuming that Donald Trump is going to be absolutely fine. And I don't know if that's a safe assumption. But even if it is, like, he's got to be quarantined for 14 days. My math may be wrong, but that puts us to October 16th, and the debate is scheduled for the 15th. They are working overtime here to avoid the fact that Donald Trump has implied from day one that if you catch COVID, you are fundamentally like sort of weak in some way. And if you attempt to avoid catching COVID, You're just virtue signaling. Well, if that's the case, it's quite clear what virtue has signaled about Donald Trump. There is an absence there, apparently, of that virtue. That is the first hour of our program. And I thank you for joining us for it. And the reason why I mention that is we have an announcement to make. And that is that the first hour of our program every day is now also going to be available on a, I don't know if it's a totally new service that's been launched by, how long has this service been out there, would you say? It's Peacock. There is a, it's an app that is a streaming app for NBC, and they have a channel that is dedicated to essentially, it's run by MSNBC. It's called The Choice, and they have put out a press release today announcing that they're going to be doing two new original shows. One will feature Mehdi Hasan, and the other will be featuring Zerlina Maxwell. But also on their schedule at 5 p.m., if you missed the first hour of this program live, you can see it on the app at 5 p.m., they will be playing a the first hour of the Majority Report. So we have made a little bit of a syndication deal, and that's pretty exciting. I'm going to give one of these things. Oh, can't find it right now. There, you guys got it. There we go. So there it is. So if you missed the show and you have the Peacock app, you can check it out over there, 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we will be playing there. So it's not going to mean huge differences for us here, but we will be basically going to a brief break, or at least providing a break at the end of the first hour. And I don't think it's going to make anything too different, is it, Brendan? Except for, I guess now we're going to consistently hit an hour. It used to be like some days we would do 50 minutes or 45 minutes. We're supposed to do 45 when the show first launched. Then I would do an hour, 6 minutes and stuff like that. But now it's an hour. Did we hit it today?
Yes.
All right. Now it is my pleasure to bring to the program the co-host of the AM Quickie. She is also a comedian. Do we have her?
Yep, here she is.
Lucy Steiner is joining us now.
Hi.
Hi, Lucy. Tell us about your co-host on the AM Quickie.
Oh, Sam Cedar?
Thank you.
Sam's great.
How are you, Lucy?
I'm good. You know, big day, sad day. Very sad.
I know,
very
you're sad, so sad
big day. I'm wearing blue in mourning.
Oh, is that what you're doing? Is blue a mourning color?
Yeah. Today. Am I the only one who thinks it's like kind of healthy for people to like sometimes want their leaders to die? Like even absent Trump. Like
in general? Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a healthy impulse.
I think so. I think, you know, if you're talking about people who, you know, value their independence.
Right. Like I don't trust people who wish death on no one. You should wish death on a couple of people. It can be me. You can wish death on me, but there should be a couple of people.
Right. On hosts of podcasts. I think that certainly happens without a doubt. Yeah. But I was sort of lamenting the fact that, like, you know, my daughter, her response is like, I hope he gets sick. And
she doesn't mess around.
No. And, you know, that's sad in a very sort of generic way. I certainly understand the sentiment.
Right.
But it's sad. I mean, right? I mean, you don't want, like, you know.
I don't want to want it. Like, I feel like I feel like there's enough, like, Catholic shame in me where, like, I feel like there is always this voice in my head going, like, you can't do that. You can't celebrate it. You got to tamp it down. But like,
I also think, I mean, to be fair, from a strategic standpoint, we don't know if there's anything to, you know, celebrate as you're talking about. and I do think that, look, folks need to keep their eye on the prize, which is Joe Biden needs to win this election. And in fact, do we have that clip of, I found interesting that it dropped sort of simultaneously. I mean, total coincidence. Here's a clip of Nina Turner. She's on with Robert Reich. I don't know if he has a podcast or what, but they were doing like a Facebook Live. And I don't know if there's another clip where she's more explicit about it, but she's basically saying, like, look, there's a sequence to these things. And you got to get Donald Trump out. And there's only one way to do it.
Of the road, why should I bother?
I think for somebody like you and me, we would say to that person, I'm going to accept what you're saying.
Pause
because
for a second.
I don't believe
I'm
that.
Sorry. Just to set this up, Rice asked Nina Turner, what if someone says, why should I bother voting? They are, you know, the candidates are more or less the same. They're not going to help me. Why should I bother voting? That's the question he gives to Nina Turner.
Listen, I'm going to accept what you're saying because I don't believe that vote shaming works. I mean, that's for me. I just don't believe that you can talk down to people and tell them that they're wrong in how they feel. A lot of their feelings also, Doc, are rooted in real life example. So it's not just a feeling. They also understand whether or not their material conditions have changed or the material conditions of their parents or their grandparents or their neighbors or their friends. I mean, right now, the millennial generation and some of the Z's on the older end. And when we say young people, I mean, we're really talking 45 years and younger. Some people, maybe not in that 45 year category, but in their 30s, have had to move back home with their parents. So through their lived experience, their material conditions have not changed much. But to say to them and to say to them, clearly what you're feeling is real. But there is a way for us, the collective us, to take control. And you might not see the change immediately, but in a representative democracy, you get to voice your opinion through the vote. And that voting is only one part of the process. So what I say to people, Doc, I say, you mad as hell? Good. I still want you to go to vote. You disappointed about the two choices? Good. So am I. I still want you to get out there to vote. And then after you vote, that's only the first part of the process. We have to actively be engaged in our communities, not just on the federal level, but the state level. We got census. We got lines that are going to be redrawn. And also on your local level of government. So voting is the beginning. It is not the end. And you can get out there and we will fight like hell and hold people accountable. Because sometimes when we talk about voting, we don't say to the voter, you have a right and a responsibility to hold the people you elect to office responsible. And if they don't respond to you, then that's another conversation. But in this moment, we have two dragons to slay, but we got to slay neo-fascism first. Doc, and you and I talked about that a lot before.
Oh, well, she went on to say, we've got to slay neo-fascism first before we slay neoliberalism. And that means you've got to vote against Donald Trump. And there's only one way to do that in this election, and that is to vote for Biden. And I think, like, you know, the bottom line is celebrating Donald Trump getting COVID doesn't necessarily get you any further down that line. And although I can understand why people are doing it in their homes, but in terms of like celebrating, Donald Trump getting sick and whatnot, it doesn't do anything for you. You know, I don't know that it necessarily hurts. But you could see it already where people are going like, I can't believe, how could people be so callous? How horrible that is. Mm. And I'm like, well, I don't know. Have you seen how he acts? I mean, right. Donald Trump was mocking Hillary Clinton when she got pneumonia.
Right.
But I don't know. It's
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way of putting it, like the way she contextualized it. Like, I think, you know, abstaining from voting in the presidential election is something I understand it a little bit more when people are coming at it from like, it's like, I have a character problem with this guy. Like, you know, someone who's like a sexual assault survivor, who's just like, I just can't get over the character issue here. That I totally understand and sympathize with. And I sympathize with the other objections too. But like, I guess one thing to clarify, like I'm planning to vote for Biden and, you know, I think one of the things that I'm a little bit confused by with some people on the left, it's definitely not like, obviously, of course, it's always exaggerated. The spoiler narrative is always exaggerated. But like, you know, when I talk to people on the left who aren't planning to vote for Biden, one of the issues that comes up for me is like, okay, look, there's this argument that voting can't fight fascism. And I understand where that argument comes from, but like, you didn't seem to believe that that was the case when Bernie may have been the nominee. So it's like in that case, right, like voting would have been at least a stave on, you know, rising fascist sentiment in the country. So like, why can't even theoretically, you know, like a center Democrat do not the same degree of correction, but some degree of correction? Yeah.
I'm baffled by that, that someone can sort of like, you know, sincerely make that argument. Well, let me put it this way. I think Turner is right when she says there is no value, and it's just simply wrong in and of itself to deny the people's lived experience in terms of politics not providing for their material benefit. Mm. And the, even the argument that it's very possible, depending on how you're situated, that neither candidate is going to address your material needs. For a lot of people, that's the case. For some, it's undeniable that their material needs are going to be improved with a Joe Biden versus a Donald Trump. I mean, it's undeniable if you're a dreamer, let's say. It's undeniable if you're an immigrant. It's undeniable if you are a member of temporary protected status folks. It's undeniable, I think, if you're transgender. I think it's undeniable. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Not even including the Supreme Court and other courts, et cetera, et cetera. But for a significant cohort of people, it's hard to imagine that Joe Biden in and of himself is going to make a material difference in someone's life. That's acceptable. But the fact is that, like, you know, there's also the years after Joe Biden that are relevant. And it may be the case that you can't fight fascism with a vote. Maybe I sort of disagree with that theory, but it's also like impossible to argue that your voting is in some way going to increase the strength of fascism.
Right.
I mean, unless you vote for a fascist. I mean, like, you know, I just don't see how that argument works. That to me, and frankly, I think the number of people who are not voting because they have that attitude is probably pretty limited.
Yeah.
I think it's more likely there are people out there going like, I don't engage in politics because politics doesn't do anything for me. And I think that it's, people have a case to make about that, but I think, like, you know, you can give up, but it's not going to get any better if you don't. I can assure you it's going to get worse.
Yeah. I mean, that's another, and I'm sure you guys have gone over this a lot on the show, but it's like, you know, yeah, that does always like need to be pointed out where it's like, look, this isn't, necessarily like a unified like left deciding not to vote. It's like, it's just, it's people from across the spectrum, independents who may not have like voted for anyone but Bernie Sanders, and just people being like pretty dejected feeling, which I totally get, you know, voter suppression factors into that. And, you know, and it's like, yeah, these concerns are real, like, right. The concerns about Biden's history, like, are real and biting for people, especially who have like, you know, who have lived through the consequences of the drug war, right? And it's like, you know, lived through the consequences of his policy decisions. So it's like, yeah, I think, look, I think the way she puts it is great, because it's like, yeah, you can't deny the reality of this. Like, and painting everyone who, you know, is threatening to abstain from voting or will abstain from voting as like lazy or selfish or privileged obviously like falls into like a really kind of gross narrative about like why people don't vote in general. But like, but yeah, I mean, I think that for people who are genuinely arguing, like, you know, like voting will not make a difference in principle. Yeah. It's like, it's always hard for me to get on board with that. Like I identify with it emotionally, honestly, right, more than I agree with it, like intellectually.
All right. Let's change topics for a moment. One of the things that's getting lost in all this hubbub these days, and from day one of the Trump administration, I think I can say this safely, I thought there was something very, very fishy about what was going on with the inauguration. They raised a tremendous amount of money, and they didn't really seem to have like commensurate production value. And it was a buddy of Melania Trump's who was in charge, who got paid something like, she got paid like, I don't know, like $30 million as like a consulting. I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me. So that may be, you know, an exaggeration, but it was a lot. Her name was Stephanie Winston Wolkoff. She had an interview with ABC News the other night. She says the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York and local attorney generals in New Jersey and Washington, D.C. are investigating the financing of the inauguration. She wrote a book, apparently, called Melania and Me. You know, this is the thing where you like, you know, if you're a dubious person, your friends are probably a little bit dubious too. And apparently they tape record you on all your conversations. Now I do that with everybody I talk to on this show. I record, but you're aware of it. I mean, you're staring into a camera. So, but here is Wolkoff has said previously that she was thrown under the bus by the Trump administration after the inaugural committee's spending came under scrutiny in 2018. In her forthcoming book, she said she was made into the cover girl for the inauguration shenanigans. The committee raised over $107 million, and she supposedly received like an inordinate amount of that as a consultant. And it sounds like, and I haven't read the book, but that scenario sounds like she was like a shell company,
right,
for a lot of people getting paid. And like she says, she was the cover girl. Here is a recording that she released that she made between Trump and Melania Trump and herself. And in this instance, Melania Trump comes out as an ally of ours in the war on Christmas.
They say I'm complicit. I'm the same like him. I support him. I don't say enough. I don't do enough.
No.
I'm working like a... I
know.
Christmas stuff that, you know, who gives a f*** about Christmas stuff and decoration, but I need to do it, right?
Yeah, but 100%. You have no choice.
And then I do it, and I say that I'm working on Christmas, planning for the Christmas, and they said, oh, what about the children? They were separated. Give me a f***ing break. Where they were saying anything when Obama did that?
I know.
I cannot go. I was trying to get the kid reunited with the mom. I didn't have a chance. Needs to go through the process and through the law.
But here's my thing. Hear what you just said. But instead of that, your messaging. You were so loved.
Would not do the story. We put it out. They would not do the story.
I'm telling
you. Would not believe it. They would not do the story because they would not do the story because they are against us because they are liberal media. Yeah, if I go to Fox, they will do the story. I don't want to go to Fox.
I mean... you know, on some level, there's a couple of things. Here's my top line for that. One is she believes all of it, right? The liberal media, the fact is that the Obama administration had a different disposition towards children and families, in some respects, radically different. She is very burdened, apparently, by doing the Christmas decorations. And she wants, you know, positive stories being put out there, but the liberal media won't do it. And she doesn't want to go to Fox because, ooh, gross. And, I don't know. I don't think it's, you know, I think it's being characterized as something worse. Like, she's obviously not like, I don't know.
Like, when she's talking about the story, like, they wouldn't do the story. Like, is she talking about, like, they tried to do some, like, fluff story where it's like she pretended to reunite a family and they just wouldn't pick it up?
I don't know what the story is, but my sense is from that snippet of the conversation that she had a, you know, story that's going to make her look good.
Right.
That they want to get out there and they can't place it anywhere because the liberal media and Fox is icky.
Yeah.
Here's, remember this little moment? I really don't care. Do you?
Yes. That was the first thing I thought of.
Yeah.
It.
Maybe it's a story about that jacket because she did that around that time, didn't she?
Right. Yeah. But that was a, maybe it was after and it was response that jacket was response to the media, not placing her story because the jacket, the message sent there was menacing. Like, I don't care what's happening with these kids in cages.
Yeah, the timeline on that is this conversation was in July 2018 and the jacket was in October 2018.
Oh, okay.
So this was a fallout from that or frustration maybe.
Mm.
Interesting. But she's definitely like, you know, when she was out there, you know, you can see footage of her back in the day before before she was first lady on Joy Behar's show talking about, you know, she's a full-on birther. She's true blue in believing it. I have to admit I have some sympathies, because of how, worthless and frustrating she thinks Christmas decorations are.
Christmas decorations are hard. You know, you put them up.
I don't know. And I'm happy not to know, but I appreciate the fact that she is so anti-Christmas.
The last thing the Trump administration needed was an inter-war on Christmas battle going into November with everything else that's going on.
I know it. COVID and now this.
Yeah.
A Tokyo Rose, basically. What is that? Is it Tokyo Rose? Is that what you would call her if she's on War on Christmas? She's Tokyo Rose.
I found it interesting how she stressed the talking point about Obama did child separations too, as if there was no difference in degree there or policy.
Yeah. Right. That's the thing is that I think that we tend to assume that they know how misinformed they are, but they don't. I think a lot of them, you know, I think like there was a report out that, where do I have it here? I think it was in the New York Times in the wake of the reports of everybody who's got coronavirus in the White House that aides started to wear masks the next day in the White House. And it's like, wait, what? They became believers,
right?
Like at that point, like, oh, I guess this is real. Like that it wasn't just sort of a sign of virility that they didn't wear masks, that they actually had some like measure of just disbelief that it was helpful in any way to wear a mask. Here it is. This is from the New York Times. On Wednesday evening, a small coterie of advisors spoke with one another about Ms. Hicks' symptoms as they flew home aboard Air Force One. Ms. Hicks was isolated in a separate cabin. So they didn't, she had tested negative, I think it was on Tuesday. And I think they were waiting for the test to come back on Wednesday when she started feeling bad. And so they put her in a sequestered area of the of Air Force One. She exited from the back of the plane as opposed to the front. By Thursday, it was clear that something unusual was happening at the White House, aide said. Several staff members who have avoided masks were suddenly wearing them. So she tested negative for COVID on Wednesday morning. She developed symptoms during the day received a second test, which came back positive. The White House knew about this Wednesday evening. Trump still had his fundraiser on Thursday. How
wow.
just like, man, the, you know, my guess is Donald Trump ends up being, you know, fine. Maybe he gets sniffles. And one of those high dollar fundraisers walks home with a commemorative case of coronavirus that ends up maybe debilitating them, if not killing them.
Right.
It's just incredibly like, man, it's just when I think of how careful and, you know, how, what kind of obligation you feel to like the people, you know, who are, you know, sort of like within your immediate, you know, a pod, as it were, or whatever you want to call it, and expanded. It's just amazing to me.
Yeah. It's like, there's no, if you have like, you know, any sense of like ethics as a human being, like there's nothing, you know, this pandemic, it's like, it messes with your mind as it should, because like, you're thinking like 10 steps ahead of like, okay, like I could go to this small gathering, but like, what if somebody gets it? They'll probably be fine. But what if they give it to this person? Like their health isn't the best. Like, you know, it's like you're always mapping out how you could potentially kill someone. And then,
yes. I mean, I think a thought, I mean, that's exactly the point. Like, I think like a thoughtful sort of like non sociopathic human being does that. You think about like, you know, what are the potential implications of my actions on other people. And it's like, look, we can't do that for every single thing, you know, that goes about. But right now, everybody is aware that there's a pandemic. And right. So you operate, you know, you respond to that. It's nuts. Here is, I'll just take a look at this, because this is a big deal, I think. We mentioned this earlier with Brandon. This is the image of the pro-life ad. I don't call it pro-life. It's really more of an anti-abortion ad in a 2006 South Bend newspaper. So we're talking about 14 years ago. And this, if you could just zoom in a little bit, the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion for any reason. Now, after more than 32 years under Roe, more than 47 million unborn children have been aborted. The majority of those abortions were performed for social reasons. I guess that's presumably like, I don't know what social reasons means. Yet poll after poll continues to show an increasing majority of Americans are opposed to abortion as a method of birth control. I think that, you know, I don't think that people use it as a method of birth control per se in the way that they would use condoms. I think they use it as it's a decision. They don't want to have a child. I mean, I guess maybe you could characterize it that way. But the fact is, the majority of Americans also believe a woman has a right to choose to have an abortion. In 2000, the Supreme Court ruled that Roe v. Wade allowed and protected the brutal partial birth abortion procedure, which, of course, is not an actual real thing. There is no partial birth abortion, a practice opposed by over 70% of Americans. It's time to put an end to the barbaric legacy of Roe v. Wade and restore laws that protect the lives of unborn children. And her name is one of those signatures on the left there. And so she has publicly weighed in on a case that is sure on some form or another to appear in front of the Supreme Court. And I think this has really scared some of the Republicans in there, because we've got a bunch of races that are super, super close. And I think, you know, there is a percentage of Republican voters who don't want abortion to be illegal. I don't know how big it is, but it doesn't have to be very big when you're talking about these very, very close races in these, you know, increasingly purple states.
Yeah. And like, you know, I think one of the more interesting things about like the abortion debate is like, more and more I view it as like less like pro-life people versus pro-choice people, and more like ideologues versus people who acknowledge that they're living in a country with other people, like where it's like, you know, because most people, yeah, like most people who would even like identify as pro-life, you know, the polls show that it's like, if you phrase the question differently, right? Like, rather than like, are you for or against abortion? Like, do you think a person should be able to have an abortion if they need one? Then even a lot of pro-life people will say, yeah, you know,
including Catholics.
Yeah. Yeah. Including Catholics. And like, so yeah, like it's definitely an issue that, you know, benefits right-wing ideologues to stack the court on it. And it's always going to benefit, you know, a more reasonable stance to let people vote on it. Right. Like it's, you know,
we have races in Iowa, Maine, North Carolina, Montana, Georgia, both seats, South Carolina, Kansas, Alabama, Colorado, Arizona, and Michigan. These are very close races. And you know, this is a suddenly, right? I mean, these races have been more or less fixed insofar as like the issue sets, right? There's no, you know, it's like the relationship with Trump and it is about, I think, the challengers getting out the question of healthcare. They're all running on healthcare. I think that is another big, very salient issue. This is one that comes in, and there's no one, I think, who's voting for a Republican or who's voting for a Democrat, let's say, who doesn't think that that vote is going to translate into a protection of the right to abortion, right? However, there are Republicans who have had the ability to ignore, because they vote Republican, to ignore the question of abortion. This makes it very difficult for them to do so. Because now there is an explicit indication of where she stands on this. And there's a reason why they hide the football, as it were, on this, even when they have the votes, right, is because they don't want to get rid of this pretense of like there's a litmus test on that side. And they don't, you know, Susan Collins, this is going to make it very, very hard for them to have the vote before the election. Like, and we can't tell, right? But when Mitch McConnell starts to sort of like back off the idea of having the vote before the election, that indicates to me that he doesn't have the votes. If he has the votes, he's going to do it. He's going to get this through. And it'll be interesting to see if these hearings actually go forward. They're scheduled for the 12th, I guess. And, you know, right now, at least one member of the Judiciary Committee, a Republican, has coronavirus. Who knows? Maybe it's more. She may have been, you know, she's tested negative, but we don't know. We're only a day out from, we're only 2 days out from, we're less than two full days out from when Hope Hicks tested positive, and 12 hours out from when Donald Trump tested positive. I think he got tested positive like at like 12 o'clock at night last night, right? So who knows? I mean, this is, we're just weird territory here.
Right. I mean, like, would they, like, I would usually, under normal circumstances, take it for granted that if enough people contracted it, they would have to postpone. But it's like, now I feel like you can't even take that for granted. Like,
right.
You know, they might just say we're not quarantining, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the quarantining's oversold.
Yeah.
You don't need that so much. Right. Here is a Fox Weekend host, Jedediah Billa, I guess. this is stunning. Play this clip. This is clip number 5.
And I think politically, this is a moment where a lot of the strategy, we've been talking about the strategy of two campaigns. I think that unfortunately now we're going to have front and center a conversation about these rallies. Because remember, the president of the United States is thankfully, luckily enough to have a team of doctors around him who are going to make sure, hopefully, that he is okay. But that conversation will become, what about the people at these rallies? How is this managed? Is this a good idea? And obviously, for all events in the future, we want to make sure that they're safe. We want to make sure everyone around them is safe. And we want to make sure it's taken seriously. This virus can be a beast. It is not for everyone, but it can be, and it can have lingering symptoms that are odd for people. So I hope that that is not the case for the first family. But you just never know. That's the bottom line. You just never know.
Coronavirus. It's not for everyone.
It's not for everybody.
Ask your doctor. Yeah.
Ask your doctor if coronavirus is right for you.
I love the fact that the lament is, you know, they may not be able to do those live rallies.
Yeah. What a tragedy.
I mean, I think it remains to be seen as to whether that helps or hurts Trump. I mean, I don't think that the rallies have had the benefit for him in 2020 that they did in 2016 by any measure. First of all, they don't get the coverage that they used to. All that comes out of it is his most sort of like grotesque moments, frankly. You know,
right? He tried his best with a lock her up chant recently, right?
Oh, did he?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it wasn't that recent.
But I'm thinking
there were locker up chants with Ilhan Omar.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But I'm thinking that like we saw Donald Trump say, you know, young people don't get it. I mean, the whole line about him saying, you know, nobody really gets it. It doesn't really hurt most people came from one of those rallies. I don't think it would come from a situation where he's like tightly scripted coming out of the White House, which he may end up having to do from now on. I mean, we're only 30 days out from the last day that you can vote. Let's put it that way, right? I mean, people should go vote right now. But this election season, the electioneering season, is we're at the tail end of this. It's nuts. All right. This is funny. So, you know, this guy, Scott Adams, have you heard this? You know who that guy
is?
Oh,
yeah.
The Dilbert guy.
Yeah. I don't know why I know it. I don't know why I know this, but I know that Sam Harris once brought him on his podcast as like a representative of the reasonable Trump supporters. I don't know why I know that. I wish I didn't know it.
Sam Harris, who hasn't made the realization we're going to find out that Scott's made regarding Trump. This is just
ridiculous, but I don't like more people. I feel like Scott Adams more famous for the fact that he is so vociferously pro Trump than actually Dilbert. Like, I can't remember what Dilbert is. I know it's a cartoon and I feel like but it was like a guy in an office, right?
Yeah, but it was syndicated in all the papers. I remember it every time I read the comments.
Dilbert might be a Trump supporter. I could see it.
Here is Scott Adams coming to the realization. This is like, you know, the interesting thing about this is that there's a lot of people, I think, making a calculation that the ship could sink. And if I don't get off it before it's still above waterline, it's going to look sort of nakedly opportunistic. So I'm going to jump off now, even though I'm aware that there's a big hole in the hull, and pretend like that's not why I'm doing it. That's what I think this is. Here is Scott Adams thinking to himself, I may need actually a couple more years of working. And so therefore, maybe I should jump off this boat before it sinks to the bottom of the ocean.
When the Fine People hoax came up again, I literally stood up from the couch and said, here it is. Here's the moment.
Pause it for one second. He's referring to the Fine People hoax. That's where you were all mistaken. And when he was talking, when he said find people on both sides, that was a hoax.
Oh, he didn't really say that. Those words didn't really come out of his mouth.
I mean, you can't take the president literally.
Right. You got to take him seriously.
Yes. Here's the moment when Trump just has to say, you know, you base your entire campaign on that lie. I just encourage everybody to look at the transcript, and you'll see that the part that they cut out is the part where I clarified that I'm condemning those groups. If he had said that, I would have said, I'm really happy that I've spent so much of my time and my personal credibility, a great deal of money. I would say that my personal financial situation is way worse, because of supporting the president. There's no question about that. And I thought, it's so obvious what you should say in this situation. And then he just didn't. And I thought to myself, I really feel abused, honestly. I took it personally. That wasn't politics anymore. That was not politics anymore. That was me personally. And I feel like he screwed me. Personally, And then I had to sit there stewing in that. And then this white nationalist, or the white supremacist question comes up, and he botched it. It was a layup. It was free money sitting on the fucking table.
Whoa.
And he left it there.
Oh.
And he left me on that table, too. He left me just exposed. So he lost my vote. He lost my vote. Can he get it back? Yeah. All he'd have to do is fix that. I mean, how hard is it to fix it? Well, apparently it's pretty fucking hard for him because he's taken 3 years since Charlottesville, and he hasn't fucking fixed it yet. Easiest fucking thing he'd ever fix.
Jeez.
I take it personally.
It wasn't this kind of swearing in Dilbert.
Some harsh words about something.
So
I'm still not sure why.
Straight. Yeah, go ahead. You walk through this first because maybe that'll help me.
I'm still not. Okay, so as far as I could gather, he's not actually mad at Trump for multiple times refusing to denounce white supremacists. He is mad at him because he feels like strategically it would have been an easy thing to do, so he should have done it. And by not doing it, you're really screwing me, Scott Adams. Right. Specifically.
He's sort of like making it, yeah, right. Like he's sort of making it like his incompetence is costing me.
Right.
But he can still fix it. Like you let this out there. I mean, I'm just using his logic. In Scott Adams' logic, the fact that Trump let this out there for 3 years and just let it lie is indicative only of incompetence. But if he's competent enough in the next 30 days to correct the record that's been the record for 3 years, then that's competent.
Right.
Like, there's no reality to any of this. Like there isn't a possible another explanation. Maybe it's not sheer incompetence that allows you to not to miss the layup for 3 years straight, right? I mean, that's almost definitional about the layup. If you're missing a layup for 3 years straight, the answer may be you just don't play basketball.
Right. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah. Like how far would he go with that? Like, oh yeah, that was like really incompetent of you to be seen burning that cross on that family's lawn. That was a huge gaffe on your part. You can still fix it.
Yeah. Go out, get another cross and put it back up there and you don't have to burn this one. And that will show me that, you know, exactly. He built in his actual actual catalyst, which is financially, I have been suffering for this, because it turns out that when you are supportive of someone who is a horrible, horrible president to millions of Americans, people don't want to associate you with that much. Which, you know, it's no book burning. I don't recall anybody going out and burning Dilbert's books in the way that, let's say, the Dixie Chicks had their albums burned when said we're embarrassed about the, George Bush.
That was brutal.
But I don't know. I can't look at Dilbert, you know, in the same way. I guess I can. Actually, I look at it exactly the same way. I haven't looked at it at all.
I'll still not read Dilbert as much as I didn't read it before.
You're going to continue to completely not read it in the same way that you always did.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think the right wing has got to be excited about this whole coronavirus thing, the infection, because it gives them an opportunity to get off this topic. So here's Ben Shapiro wrestling with this thing still, too.
He has now said in the first 10 seconds of this clip, sure, twice, sure. And then he says again, sure, I'm willing to do that. And then Trump turns, right? He turns and he swivels and he says, I don't understand why we're talking about right-wing violence in cities that are being dominated by left-wing violence. I don't understand this. Why aren't we talking about BLM? Why aren't we talking about Antifa? That is a perfectly legitimate point. Okay, and then Wallace, because he was terrible the other night, decides that he's going to double down on this. Yes, sir, but will you he already did twice. He said, sure, two times. If he wanted to say no, he would just shake his head, or he would say no. You think Donald Trump is unwilling to say things that piss people off? He does it all the time.
Sure.
Okay, but the fact is that he does condemn white supremacy. He does condemn these people who are committing violence in the cities if they are from the right. Okay, this is, like, I'm sorry, but okay, so there's literally a three-word thing that Trump says in the rest of this exchange that everybody on the left is hanging their hat on to claim that he is, in fact, a white supremacist. Okay, and the only way that you can read this is if you think that Trump is exact with his language, which we all know he is not. It is amazing how the left, which fully understands that Donald Trump is wildly inexact with his language, that Donald Trump routinely says dumb crap, how suddenly they get super serious and meticulous about his literal language all the time. Now, listen, I understand the left saying to people on the right, you know, you guys, you say that you should take him seriously, not literally, and that lets him out of the, that lets him basically say whatever he wants to say, and we're supposed to read into his words. But I don't even take him seriously. I've said this all along. I've been very consistent about this. I don't think that virtually anything Trump says ought to be taken seriously because I don't think that he's the world's most serious person. I don't think it's possible to look at Trump and think he's the world's most serious person. I think very often there's a core of truth to things that he says, but I do not think that he is exact in his language. I don't think that he thinks out what he's doing beforehand. It doesn't. Okay. So here is the rest of the exchange.
How do you go on and say, I don't take the president seriously? This guy has the ability to launch nuclear weapons,
right?
Like, even if you think he's a joker and he's an idiot or he's incapable of tying his shoes, you got to take what he says seriously because he is arguably one of the most powerful single individuals, if not the, based upon his access to those nuclear weapons in the world. And he has had the ability of deporting, a whole raft of people. He's had the ability to arrest people, to have them beaten. I mean, this is pretty nuts.
Yeah, like, and also to say it while also being a person who will probably vote for him. Like, it's one thing to say, I don't take this guy seriously, which is obviously why he shouldn't be in a position of power. But it's like to say, oh, I don't take him seriously. And also, like, I'm going to vote for him because what's the thing he always says? He surprisingly did the most conservative governance I've seen in my lifetime. Right. Like, that's what I'll say at like a CPAC. And like, you know, but it's like, honestly, that clip, it was a little bit more sympathetic to me because it feels like that felt a little bit more like, oh, like on some level, he desperately wants it to be not true that he's supporting a white supremacist.
Right.
Like, he's really, you know, he's really like flailing there. And it's like, no, it can't be true. Of course he doesn't. Of course he said, sure. What more do you want?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That's a full throated denouncement of white supremacy. He said the word sure twice.
Like, course he doesn't.
There's no way the president could ever say, like, look, white supremacy is horrible, and these people who are doing this are horrible, and they should, and you know, they are the number one threat. Like, he won't acknowledge that what his own FBI director said about either about Antifa or about white, you know, these white supremacist groups, and the idea that like Donald Trump says things that upset people all the time, and not really any of the white supremacists.
Right. Yeah. He never seems to upset them.
It's quite a coincidence for a guy who's so imprecise with his language. Somehow he manages not to offend the bigots.
Right. He's a big hit with them. And also, like, maybe he does address it. Like, I don't know. Maybe it just wasn't there, but he doesn't even seem to get to the point where he told them all to stand by. Right. Like, he doesn't even seem to like be able to say that he said those words. Yeah.
The argument that they're saying about Trump, and I think there's probably, I mean, I'm not going to, I mean, like, the funny thing is that Shapiro's up there saying, don't take him literally. Don't take him literally. Yet here he is parsing out every single exchange and every single word, which he says is really just about that fed him the idea of the Proud Boys because Biden says it. And Chris Wallace is feeding him specific words. Like, they're taking this literally. They're the ones who are taking this exchange literally as a way of defending the president's long record.
That's a good point.
Of encouraging softly, like, let's be clear. His meaning, even if he says, sure, sure, his meaning is like, I don't take it that seriously.
Yeah, when, yeah, sure, sure.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, like, you're right, because it's like, we're critics of him are really just listening to him the way you would expect a normal person to listen to another normal person. Like, they're the ones who it's like, you have to separate every single word out and give it a, and give it way more meaning than it deserves, and then separate other words out and give them way less meaning than they deserve. Like,
ask me if I'm concerned about the fire.
Are you concerned about the fire?
Sure, sure. But the real problem is the fact that we've got, you know, there's a the trees are starting to get a little bit overgrown over there, and we've got to trim them back. You know, the literal interpretation is that, yes, sure, sure, I'm concerned about the fire. But the interpretation of the meaning is he's not that concerned about the fire. He's looking for any other thing out there that is more important than the fire.
Ben Shapiro, of course, has made a career of, you know, running interference for racists that everyone knows are racists. So,
right.
This is Ben Shapiro. Media accuses Representative Steve King of racism. They're lying. Read his actual words.
And then this is the update.
White women to reproduce more, right?
The Republican Party also came to that same conclusion, but a little bit after Ben. Ben just really has a trouble with the English language in terms of like interpreting meaning as opposed to specifics on words. This guy, man, that's why I think they're psyched that he got coronavirus, because I think it makes them. Like, it gives them an opportunity to change topics. Oh, this is great. Did you see this where Katie Porter? It's amazing. I don't think there's anybody who does this better than her, frankly, in terms of these committee hearings. I don't know. If it wasn't for the ability, if she was, you know, like if she was in media, like no one would ever go on her show because they would be afraid to. She was at the House Oversight and Reform Committee. She is looking at the price hike for Revlimid, which is a cancer drug. And it's a fairly common cancer drug, right? It's like one of these drugs that's been out there for a while. And the drug companies realize, like, wait a second, we can jack up the price on this. And she has
one drug company.
What's that?
One drug company.
Right. One drug company. It's a, what are they called? I can't pronounce it. Celgene, I guess it is.
Celgene.
And she has the CEO, Mark Alice, come in front of her committee. It's all by Zoom, of course. And listen to this exchange. It's fantastic.
Do you know what this number is? Does it ring any bells?
I think you're referring to my compensation in some way.
Yeah, well, in some way. This was your compensation in 2017 for being CEO of Celgene. And that's a lot of money. It's 200 times the average American's income and 360 times what the average senior gets on Social Security. Now, of that $13 million, about $2.1 million came from your company hitting yearly earning targets. And more than half of the bonus formula was based on those targets. Any increase in the price of Revlimid would also increase your bonus by increasing earnings. Isn't that right, Mr. Ellis?
If revenues increased and expenses did not, then earnings would be enhanced. And
thank you. Mr. Ellis, in fact, the Oversight Committee found that if you hadn't increased the price of Revlimid, you wouldn't have gotten your bonus. Mr. Ellis, do you know how much you personally received in bonuses over 2 years, the last 2 years, just because Celgene raised the price of this one drug, Revlimid?
I receive very generous compensation, but I don't know the exact number that you're referring to.
In fact, you personally received $500,000 personally just by tripling the price of Revlimid. So to recap here, the drug didn't get any better. The cancer patients didn't get any better. You just got better at making money. You just refined your skills at price gouging. And to be clear, the taxpayers spent $3.3 billion on Revlimid.
That's the way it works. That's the way it works. And of course, you know, that money that he gets in the bonus form, incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll get that in the form of tax. I mean, excuse me, in form of stock options, and it's taxed at a different rate. It's taxed at a different rate than wages. And of course, in terms of payroll taxes, he's done after the first 110,000. So that leaves him 12 million, roughly $880,000 of pay that is not subject to the payroll tax. So that's pretty good.
Why doesn't everybody just do that? What she's doing, like, it is so effective.
That's the thing, is like, what she laid out there is not actually all that complicated to lay out. Yeah. Those are like public numbers, you know. She showed that, you know, there wasn't any improvement in the treatment, and it's known knowledge that it's the most expensive drug for Medicare and Medicaid users in the country. So, I mean, it's baseline work.
Yep.
Right.
And, you know, the value of like a single payer healthcare system is their ability to negotiate with those entities. But, you know, now we have, but it's also, you know, this is the idea that a drug company can simply own the patent and raise the price simply because they own the patent. It's just, we should not allow that. We have the ability as a society to decide, like, look, when you're dealing with these, you know, we do it with utilities. The utility company does not have the ability to just randomly increase the price of the electricity or your phone service or your gas or water service that comes into your home. You can't just randomly say, you know what? We have the ability to raise it three times. We're going to do it.
Well, to be fair, your body isn't nearly as essential as those things.
That's true.
Your human living body.
That's true. You could still live as an orb somewhere, and you don't want to do that in the dark. Much harder on an orb's eyes to see in the dark.
Another quick point about Porter and, you know, this strategy. David Dayan pointed out the fact that, you know, this is a woman who represented a formerly like safe Republican suburban district that's fairly wealthy. And now she is running for reelection, does not have like any sort of challenge, really, any sort of legitimate challenge against her seat. She's pretty much locked it in for now. Mm.
The point is that politically speaking, you do not pay a price for going after people like this. In fact, it strengthens you.
Yeah, you lose nothing.
I am very, very anxious to see the current Democratic leadership make way for the generation of Democrats in Katie Porter's class.
You made the point a few weeks ago, Sam, that, like, you know, Republicans put whoever is most effective to the front of the line to run their committees. Do you see that happening at any point in the Democratic order? Or is that something that you feel just mostly hopeful about?
I think that's conceivable. I think once a younger generation of Democrats gets into office, one that is not so ossified, not simply because of their age, but in terms of how long they've been there, I think people who are more concerned, who are doing this because they have a political project, right? I mean, I think that's really the bottom line, is that now I don't know if that's something that has changed. I don't know if 30-year-old first-year, second-year congressperson Nancy Pelosi came in with a different perspective than, say, AOC or Katie Porter, just, you know, as an example. I suspect she did, but I certainly am convinced that the years and her experience at that time changed her to some degree as well. And maybe, and I don't know how to assess, you know, I would have to wait for the biography, I guess, which shows that, like, oh, she came in just as idealistic and with a very, you know, a project in this disposition. And when she came in and, you know, they got crushed, you know, McGovern and through those years, it had a lasting impact on her, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Ryan Grimm's book,
Nancy and Me.
Yeah, well, Ryan Grimm's book sort of like outlines this a little bit. Like, you know, that they were tried by fires in the early 90s and still a huge hangover from McGovern at that time. And I don't know. But my suspicion is that politicians who come of age now have a fundamentally different sort of agenda and incentive structure than politicians who came of age 30 years ago. And I'm talking specifically within the Democratic Party and probably to a certain extent in the Republican Party, except for it's just like gone on a certain trajectory. In the Democratic Party, I think it's gone in the opposite direction. And I think that's a good thing. I think we just can't get there early enough, frankly.
Right.
This is a little disturbing. Maybe it's to be expected. PBS Frontline interviewed a woman from Texas. She wants as to why she opposes Section 8 low-income housing. And in her neighborhood, this is classic NIMBYism. Maybe it's like NIMBYism, like not in my country. I don't know how to do that. Go ahead.
Some residents voice concerns about traffic, others about overcrowding in their schools.
Hi, nice to meet you.
And some were worried about having low-income housing in their neighborhood.
Why did you pick this spot?
Nicole Humphrey is a local opponent of the development.
What is your concern when it comes to Section 8 and low income?
The lifestyle I feel like that is goes with Section 8 is usually working single moms or people who are struggling to keep their heads above water. And it's not, I feel so bad saying that, but it's just not people who are, I guess, of the same class as us, which sounds bad, but I don't mean that in a bad way.
Some people would say, you know, look, they maybe not have not had the opportunities that their kids are not going to have the opportunities that your kids are going to have in this neighborhood.
Right.
Can they share in that?
The problem with that is I hear a lot of the unfair of, oh, we haven't been given this or not that, or we haven't been afforded things that you might have been afforded. I don't look at multimillionaires and think, why don't I have a yacht? Why don't I have a private jet? It's a mindset, I feel like.
Do you think that you maybe are stereotyping the folks?
Oh, I totally am. 100%. It's not. It works both ways. I'm definitely not a racist and I'm not a bigot, but I think I hold a little bit of a stigma against people who are different. We don't want nomads. We don't want people who don't have roots. I just don't want that to be what my community is about.
Wow. And she's young, too. I mean, like, I know people exist like this who are young, but it's like, yeah, I was expecting something a little bit different. I mean, this is the kind of thing where it's like sometimes when people express views like this about low-income housing, like I feel like sometimes it's appropriate to assume a level of ignorance, you know, or a level of being, like, influenced by, like, scaremongering. But this woman is just, like, nakedly, like, no, I just don't want poor people here. You know, but
it's so weird to that sort of like that paradox of some measure of self-awareness. Like, I know this sounds bad, but I don't mean it that way.
The laughter when she explodes in laughter because she's realizing what she's saying is just horrendous is
what
must be
the look
watch.
On the face of like the woman interviewing her going like, what are you?
I mean, I think there's some internal morality, like, trying to fight out there, too. Like, you cannot be saying this. And by the way, she's, like, saying, I'm not a bigot, but I just behave exactly the way a bigot does around people who are different than me.
I just like, that's bigotry. She, like, almost defined it. Like, I hold a stigma towards those who are different from me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's got to be close to the textbook definition.
I mean, you would think, I have such a hard time sort of wrapping my head around this. Like, you know, that she has the self-awareness. What I'm saying is, I know, sounds horrible. but it's actually not that what she's saying sounds horrible. It's what she's saying is horrible.
It is horrible.
Like, it is horrible. And like, It is, the problem is not that you're articulating it. The problem is like all the other things that are involved with that. And it's like, I could see, like, you know, like on one hand, I'd be like, what? I mean, if I felt that and I felt like I really need to tell the people on the TV about it, right? Like, which I think is like an interesting combination. I mean, because on one hand, she clearly does not understand why that's so bad, right? I mean, otherwise, I mean, she knows that it sounds bad, but she doesn't understand why it is bad.
Right. Yeah.
And you could, you know, like if she understood why it is bad, maybe she would have the sophistication to say like, look, I don't think the problem is going to be solved by public housing. The problem is going to be solved by a much bigger investment on the part of the public. Therefore, I need to see not just public housing for people, but we need to see a whole investment into communities so that other communities can be just as good as one. Like she needs to be arguing like separate but equal.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, yeah. But then she comes in with like, look, I'm not a millionaire. Now, I don't know. That house looked pretty nice. I'm not a millionaire and I don't sit around fretting about, you know, millions. So they don't have a right to be like, I need housing. I need healthcare. I need food. Like,
there's I need a well-funded school.
Yeah, there's no concept of necessities. It's just like, right. I'm not as doing as well as they are, and I can live with that. You know, they right. have to live with that. They're not doing as well as I am. But she totally misses, like...
Yeah, like, that's part of the myth of, like, that everyone in America is, like, it's all just, like, levels of relative comfort. It's like, oh, like, sure, they're poor, but they must be comfortable, right? Like, they must be comfortably poor. Like, you know, this is
America.
They
have a big screen TV.
Right. Yeah.
I've been by those houses. They have air conditioners.
Right.
I think part of the confusion is that, like, this is how the country is set up. She's like, so I know this sounds bad to elaborate, but if it's so bad, why have we, just inherited the system that was set up explicitly to stratify people by class and race like this, right? like she's confronting the system versus the what we say is, you know, ideally what America should be.
I guess to a certain extent, too, I would want to know, like, you say it sounds bad. Why? Why does it sound bad?
Yeah.
Like interrogate that notion of like why she thinks it sounds bad.
I don't know. I can understand as someone who's done like field interviews like this, when you get someone to say something so insane, they might retract it, which, you know, they can't, but you know, you kind of don't want to play your hand too far.
No, I understand that. I understand that. I've done some of that.
How bad can you make yourself look right now, ma'am? Please, let's just ride this.
Well, yeah. I mean,
I might even like, I don't know. I mean, I would be really interested to like just turn the camera off. Well, actually secretly keep it on. But you know, turn the camera off and say like, but what, like it sounds bad, but why does it sound bad to you?
Right.
And how is that different from actually what is actually happening?
This is where like the method of, I think like a certain degree of social shaming is like necessary, where it's like, there are some positions like just blanketly and automatically being opposed to public housing in your neighborhood, like it just has to be one of those positions where it automatically gets you shit from your neighbors. You know, it's got to become that, where it's like, you know, because I think it's one of those things where people, like, it is such a bigoted position to hold, but it's one of the last positions where it's like people still seem to feel comfortable holding it, where it's like they still feel like, you know, where like people don't seem to feel the need to like obscure that position,
right?
Like other blatantly bigoted positions, you know?
Right. And I think the value of that is, I think the value of that is to sort of disempower them in these sort of like local struggles, frankly. I mean, you know, it's basically, you know, that is like, you know, people say like, oh, sometimes you hear on the left, like you shouldn't moralize in that way.
Right.
I mean, I guess unless it is a question of class. I mean, sometimes that goes back and forth. But you know, the value of moralizing and shaming in that respect is because it's all a struggle of power, and it's an effective tool. Social shaming is an effective tool in terms of promoting change,
and honestly,
in the proper way.
it works in the opposite way too, like, and has historically, like, to me, this is like no different. Like, it's really no different in essence than, like, you know, the first Black family being kicked out of the Levittown suburbs because of just like the unbridled, like, unacceptance and rage of their neighbors, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, the attitudes of people, you know, living in these communities, like, matter, and, like, you know, yeah, like, forcing them to change matters.
I agree.
Because it's their attitudes that's going to make the lives of low-income people miserable, ultimately.
I just want to point out also the it's a mindset after saying, you know, I don't care about billionaires. Yeah, it's a class stratified caste system mindset, basically.
Right.
It's pretty impressive. All right, let me call into the phones and we'll take we're late, so I'm going to take one or two calls and that is it, ladies and gentlemen. I don't even know how long I'll be able to stay on the line. I got to get that upgraded. Here we go. Calling from a 509 area code. I didn't realize callers have been on the line for so long. This guy's been on for a long time.
So long. Sam, I had to wake up at 4 a.m. Pacific time to get through because of my shadow ban.
Oh, Ronald Reagan has been shadow banned from the show, and somehow he defeated it. What are you calling from? Like some type of like a special number, 509?
But well, right. I'm just saying I had to wake up extra early because you only let in like two calls at a time now. People don't understand how rigged the system is these days. It's totally rigged.
Totally rigged. Ever since David Pakman got 1 million subscribers, I've had to crack down.
Austerity.
Speaking of rigged, by the way.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, this guy steals your set, and then the next thing you know, he's getting write-ups in the New York Times.
Yeah, I saw that.
Coincidence? I don't know. Anyways, I wanted to propose. I got a script idea for you. This is a Hollywood call. Okay.
Good. We have Lucy on. Lucy's in show business.
It's a war on crime, war on Christmas. Sorry, war on Christmas heist movie with you and Benjamin and Matthew Dumguy, Andy Kimmler, kind of like an Ocean's 11 thing, right?
Right.
So, spoiler alert for the listeners, but the final scene is you've been captured. The heist is you're going to steal all the Christmas decorations at the White House.
Oh, right.
And you've been captured. You're sort of the leader. Maybe we make Kenler the leader. I don't know. But you've been captured, and you're in the Oval Office. The president pulls out a Clint Eastwood oversized revolver, right? He's pointing it at you.
I believe Clint Eastwood would often, in those films, you're talking about the Dirty Harry films, and even maybe the Enforcer, he would carry a Magnum 44.
That's right. That's right. Oversized, clearly compensating, right? Behind the president is Melania. She's standing there, very menacing, right?
Hmm.
She only makes the one face, but it's menacing. And he points the gun at you. He says, any last words? And then there's a tight shot of you. You say, happy holidays, motherfucker. And then there's a gunshot, and you flinch. And you look up, and the president slumps over in his chair. He's been shot by Melania. Right. This is a surprise twist.
No, of course. This is I saw it coming, but as soon as you said there was a gunshot, I flinched as opposed to actually got
you
shot.
Flinched.
Right.
Yes. Okay. So, and then she says something about who cares about the fucking decorations? And it turns out she has been fucking John Benjamin for like a really long time.
Jeez.
And they were working kind of a side thing during the whole heist, and she was in on it all along. You didn't realize. But this is my idea for you. You can take it and run with it.
I mean, I'm going to need a little bit of, like, you know, you gave me the cast and then the last scene, but there's a lot of stuff. That's not really a script idea. That's just a scene idea. That's like
opening,
a skit.
The opening scene, you get done with the show. You're talking about Social Security or something boring, and you take off your headphones, and it's the closing music, and you look over at the TV, and there's Trump lighting the Christmas tree, and Matt says something like, "Good show today, Sam," and it's clear.
Oh, this is completely unbelievable. so far, but go ahead.
Betting that he would say that. So you're looking at the TV and it's clear that you don't really care about that show you just did, Social Security, whatever. You're obsessed with the war on Christmas, and you've got to do something about the one true issue.
I don't have my Born Identity music on this board. I got to get it. This is where I go, wee, wee. And I know I got it. I got it. And then like I go into like some type of bat cave or something, right?
Well, yeah, there's got to be some sort of scene about getting the crew back together, right? Something along those lines. I haven't totally fleshed this out, to be honest.
I think that's pretty apparent. I mean, you're not holding that back.
No, I think you should do it. I think this could become a Christmas classic, similar to like kind of how Die Hard sparks that debate. Like, is Christmas Tree, Sam Cedar, Christmas Heist really a Christmas movie? Yeah.
Right. Right.
And then there's a scene where Kendler's like trying to get into the White House as like a handyman, and he's like, I'm a plumber. Wait, am I believable as a plumber? Am I doing this right? And is like, and then he just punches the guy.
Right. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Wow. That is spot on. That's exactly the scene that we need. How many times?
Can I start this over? I don't think I'm doing this right. Is this how a plumber stands? Does a plumber stand like this? And he just punches the guy right in the face.
I gotta get Kindler on next week to pitch this to him. Because, you know, if Kindler's in, this could happen. I'm being facetious.
Nobody hates Christmas like Kindler.
Right. No, it's true. But I'm being facetious. Nobody you've referred to has the ability to greenlight this thing. Might have to be a low budget production.
Well, you know. All right.
All right.
That's all. Have a good day.
You too. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Ronald Reagan bringing it. Moon in the Lake. What if it happens if a presidential candidate dies? I'm a little scared to have extra chaos added to the heaping pile of chaos. How does that work ballot wise and election wise? There's a lot of people who are trying to figure that out right now, to be honest with you. I mean, because it's unlikely still, but it's conceivable. There's a lot of people who are saying that in some ways, the whole state legislature choosing an electors, crew of electors could come into play. I mean, presumably, I think if something were to happen to Donald Trump, then Mike Pence would be the obvious choice I don't know. I mean, I really don't know what happens at this stage. Somebody appoints somebody. I don't know. I mean, the courts would have to say, like, yeah, the votes that accrued, because, you know, remember now, huge percentage of the electorate has voted now. Not a majority, but there's a lot of votes have been cast. I don't know. I imagine you guys already saw that the South Dakota governor, COVID Christie, was at the Trump super spreader rally in Duluth, hugging and laughing and singing karaoke with all the other COVID deniers. When was that? Matt, do you know when that happened?
I mean, that was very recently. Yeah,
or Monday, rather. Yeah.
I mean, we don't know who around the president had it. Now, my understanding is the RNC chairwoman tested positive. I don't know where she was. I think in the next day or two, we're going to have contact tracing and we're going to basically see maps of like where this may have traveled through around. I mean, it's maybe that is where Hope Hicks got it. Although, we just don't know how long it took to develop in her. Like, I mean, she got tested on Wednesday morning and was negative and then was positive by the end of day. Maybe 3 or 4 days earlier could have been where they got contracted it. On the topic of the Section 8 housing woman, as someone who is probably a younger listener, and I went to a conservative all boys private high school, I'm not as taken back by her openness. She represents the modern young conservative that finds no need to hide the reality behind their beliefs, unlike their parents and grandparents' generations. Why should she feel the need to hide behind complicated mental gymnastics when she sees how popular her naked beliefs are around the country? I mean, I guess that's true. Yes, You Lock. Is MR going to be on the free tier of Peacock or the paywalled? We're going to be on the free tier. I think the way it works on Peacock is you get it with ads. If you're on the that their free tier comes with ads, I think. And then I'm not exactly sure how they do it with the pay thing. Big Dick Cheney Energy. Fun fact: The Enforcer was indeed a Dirty Harry movie. Yes. A comrade Mario on the top. Got that. Monk Lewis. I imagine you got, yeah, I got that. Moon in the Lake. What happens if a presidential candidate? Oh, we know that. I will look into that. We will know that on Monday. Eddie from Ohio just saw the local news last night that Cincinnati, that schools are having football games this weekend. My mom works in public schools, and I asked her if this is true. She said, yes, they're all doing it and also holding indoor basketball practices with parents in attendance, no masks. Great leap forward. Who gives an F about Hanukkah, Sam? Woody, will you take my 814 call? We could talk about Judge for Justice. Yes, I will. Call him from an 814 area code. Who's this?
This is Woody.
Hi, Woody. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to tell you about something that's going on in South Carolina.
Please do.
It's basically a police brutality kind of thing. A cop shot a 17-year-old kid. Oh, yeah. And basically racially profiling. And they're also finding that this cop only arrests 17-year-old black men.
Only arrests 17-year-old black men? Like, period? That's it? That's the only arrest on their that they had?
Mostly that they went through and looked at his record, and most of his arrests were 17-year-old black men.
Jeez. Wow.
And he almost shot a dog a few years ago.
Where is this? Woody, before we talk too much. Where does this take place?
Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay. Do you have any like specific knowledge of it, or is stuff that you've read in the paper?
I'm not like with the actual like organization, but I am kind of helping. I don't know like a lot of.
What is the organization? What is the organization? What's the organization?
Justice for Josh. They have an Instagram page, and I think they're on YouTube too.
All right. We'll check it out.
We'll check it out,
and we'll dig into it, and maybe we'll talk about it next week. But thank you, Justice for Josh in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina. We'll look into that. All right, we get time for one more phone call, and that is it, folks. I'm sorry. It wasn't even my plan to take calls, but we forgot to turn the voicemail on. Call from a 478 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
That's right, sir. You did forget to turn the voicemail off. So that's why you have the privilege of talking to Jeff in Georgia, Sam.
Jeff in Georgia. Lucy, do you ever listen to The Dissident Peasant?
I'm sorry, please.
I'm sorry to say I haven't heard it.
Well, put that on your list of podcasts to listen to.
Yeah, I will.
It's a great show. I know, like, political podcasts a little bit played out, just people having a conversation or whatever. I think it's time to write a script and just read it, which some people will like a little bit different. But, Sam, I'm not here to talk about myself. I'm here to let you know, man, I really appreciate you. I really appreciate the words you had to say about at the top of the show about, people who got all the sympathy in the world for Trump right now. Oh boy, isn't he going through a bad time? And I do really appreciate all that. But Sam, I want to take another tack because I see on my feed on Twitter a lot of people, they're giddy with celebration. They're getting happy. They're feeling maybe even hopeful about Trump's infection in the course thereof. And I just want to let all those people know that before you make a viral video of you dancing, you need to do stretches properly. Before you wear out your voice laughing uncontrollably You need to do vocal exercises. You don't need to get into a state of euphoria or drunken stupor and forget that you have children that need to take care of. Folks, I know this is exciting, but I want you to take care of yourselves. Your health is very important. Everyone's health is very important to me. Save one particular individual's health. His health not very important to me at all, indeed. The opposite of that, Sam. I just wanted to get that message out.
That is very...
Take care of yourselves.
That is very thoughtful of you, Jeff from Georgia. I appreciate that. Very much a public service announcement. Thank you.
Perfectly healthy.
And that also reminds me, ladies and gentlemen, it is Flashback Friday, and maybe we may do this on a regular basis, but we're certainly going to do it today. This is... a clip of Michael when he heard that Jair Bolsonaro had contracted COVID. Now, of course, I'm sure his reaction today, were he with us, would have been much more reserved, but we don't have any footage of him being more reserved. So let's play this today. Flashback Friday.
Trying to tell me Bolsonaro tested positive. I see it in a tweet from a verified account. It's translated. So let's, you know, let's confirm that. But that's very, that's very exciting.
Lula libre.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And it looks like apparently Dr. Bertrand, Washington Post. Yeah, this is. And he just had dinner with Trump.
Hell yeah. You know, it's good to get some good news once in a while.
There's always silver linings. Well, whoever knew that so much good could have come out of Mar-a-Lago?
Dirtbag MLK.
Fingers crossed. We may be living in hell world, but no one said the comedy was bad.
Oh, shit. Yo, they hugged.
We should pull up that video of them in Mar-a-Lago before we go.
We really are in uncharted waters right now.
All right.
Beautiful.
That was great.
That was fun.
Nice.
All right, a couple IMs, then we'll get out of here.
I don't think I've ever seen it such pure joy.
I know it. Sweater.
There was a time we played Drake's Hotline Bling when Scalia died, which was also up there, mm-hmm. but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sweater weather underground. Both parties have rules that say the VP nominee moves up on the ticket. So there you go. Ty from Tennessee. I don't know if you've seen covered this, but Joe Biden tested negative today. We did mention that. You know, they've got to test them. They've got to keep testing them. I mean, you know, it's conceivable that if you got infected on a Tuesday night, it wouldn't register for another day or two, but that's a good thing. The negative testing, I imagine they're going to test them again. Honk goes the truck. As a cancer doctor, I totally agree about the heinous absurdity of Revlimid, also known as lenalidomide. There's some nuance, however, which is recently Revlimid was found to be useful in relapsed, indolent, and aggressive lymphomas instead of just multiple myeloma. But there's an even bigger general problem with the cancer drug space. Drug price points were historically set during an era when cancer drugs didn't work too well. So even though the drugs were expensive, patients didn't survive long enough to rack up a hefty cumulative bill. In this most recent decade, however, our newer meds, namely targeted immune and cell-based therapies, are suddenly giving people 5 to 10 years added life expectancy, which is an honest game changer. Naturally, drug companies are demanding massive payouts for this breakthrough. But these drugs still aren't cures, and patients are now racking up 5 to 10 years of exponentially more expensive treatments compared to that prior 3 to 6 months. This is all about to blow up if it hasn't already. It looks bleak. My hope is this new financial catastrophe might encourage more research on early access to cancer screening and prevention where cures are possible. Excellent. Thank you, Hunko's Truck. militant apathy. In my actual real life experience, the cops that like to shoot dogs, and there are quite a few, tend to be the cops that have other major issues. I mean, I think that's also the case with just individuals, right? I mean, I will get to that Supreme Court case. I'm saying, like, you know, people who hurt animals also tend to have, like, issues with human beings, broadly speaking. Trump change, hoax-tober, Trump will recover because he's a Superman. Disco Stew, what do you make of Biden campaign rolling out a door-knocking plan, right? Seems late, odd. What are they reacting to? Maybe pressure, maybe help for down ticket races. Maybe they're concerned. I mean, maybe they think, maybe timing wise, this makes sense relative to a little bit earlier. I don't know. I'm concerned about all of it, to be honest with you. I'm going to be concerned until, you know, till we see the inauguration, and then I'm going to, and then it's going to turn from concern to more like fighting for an agenda, but I'm concerned. Yes. Snack the courts. Have a great weekend, Sam. Thank you. Callie Fist, what does Donald Trump's quarantine look like? I imagine he's roaming the White House and the staffers are trying to hurt him to stay in place. I mean, he really should be quarantining, but I mean, I can't imagine that he cares that much about the people around him. Venture Pessimist, I was just about to ask for this Michael clip. Thank you. June reluctantly. Oh my God, that clip. I want to send it to everyone. Oregon, Nalix. Yes. Oh my God. Michael would have loved this. Stone Man, take my 401 calls next week. Get on the phone with Stone. I have a question for you that will get views. Okay. And the final I am of the week before we get there. Lucy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. People can hear you 2 to 3 times a week on the AM Quickie. You're great on it. Thank you so much. Matt, Brendan, good week, guys. Jamie, good week. Cheney from Florida, thank you for all you guys do. Tomorrow is my 25th birthday. I am hoping to get a show far. Here it is. See you on Monday.
It might take us through that guy to where I want, but I know some.